Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck, buddies? What the fuck, Nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. This is the home stretch coming in for landing. How's everybody? You okay? You holding up? I got to be honest with you. I do so much better when I talk to other people. Man, I don't know. If I'm left to my own devices in my own head, it's not a great situation. Currently, I know a lot of you have listened to me over the years. You've heard me go through things. You've heard me transcend some things. You can see probably better than me the things that are still there, the remaining patterns, the spiral of circular thought, maybe the diameter. Is it the diameter spreads out? Is that it? What's it? The radius is the one from the center to the edge, and the diameter is the whole thing. Maybe the diameter of each spiral spreads out, kind of like an expanding universe. But they're still there, man. They're still fucking there. Today, and I don't know if any of you can relate to this, today I woke up and I wanted to claw out of my body. I just wanted, you know, I just don't. Some days, usually food related, these are the deep ones. These are the deep issues. The deep down body image, food, fat, / your gross spiral. Definitely the most existentially rooted one. And it's just odd. I go through these times where, look, I don't know why, and I'm not bragging, but Men's Health wants to do a story on me. All right. So that means they want to do some photos of me. And I don't know what that means. I don't have a six pack. I don't have, you know, I'm in good shape. I look all right. I talked about this before. I know, but it's coming up. And there's some part of me, and I guess I just have to take notice when this happens. I know I've got this shoot in a couple of days, and I don't know why. I'm happy to do it, but, you know, I'm not going to be doing any shirts off kind of things. I'm not going to be doing any workout pictures. I don't even know if my regiment is on the level. I know it works for me. Look, I know I'm fit, but come on, dude. This is a lot of pressure. I've been avoiding abs my entire life with the belief that someday I'll have them. But I know that's not going to happen because a couple of reasons. I don't have the discipline to do that. And, you know, both on a dietary level or on an exercise level. I exercise. I got muscles. I'm in good shape. I eat well. Don't feel great. Hardly ever. But I don't think it's dietary. And I'm going to be 62 in September. But still, there's this thing hanging over me, which is a Men's Health profile. I'm like, okay, it's fine. What fucking difference does it make? Just tell them what you eat. Tell them what your exercise regimen is and answer the questions about your life that they want to hear. No problem. But the point is now it's days away and I've been plowing through a fucking pint of ice cream two nights in a row. Yesterday, I had leftover chili from 4th of July, but I didn't have any cornbread. So me and Kit are eating this chili. We're gonna. And I'm like, well, I can make cornbread. It takes 2 seconds. So now I've got a fucking tray of cornbread in there that I'm just eating. You know, there's no way to lie about how much cornbread you've eaten or cake when the whole tray or whole cake pan is right there. You can see it slowly go away. Just taking slivers at a time, thinking like, oh, this is cool. But any way you slice it, literally, you'll see it's fucking gone in 3 days. And that's all gone into your fat face. Sorry, that's wrong. Into your dumb hole. How's that? Better? So basically what I'm saying is some part of me knowing that this is coming up, I want to make myself as miserable as possible in the days leading up to that. So that's happening. Pretty fun. Pretty fun day. Look, on the show today, I talked to Jenna Friedman. I've known Jenna a long time. She does stand-up. She was a producer at The Daily Show. She was a writer on Letterman. She was one of the writers on Borat 2, which got her an Oscar nomination. She's got a couple of specials out there, and she'll be doing a new special at the Edinburgh Fringe in Scotland next month. Yeah. And we haven't talked in a while. And I think we're through the tension. But yeah, I mean, we had a nice conversation. Also, I'm back at Largo for a comedy and music show on Wednesday, July 23rd. And I'll be in New York at the 92nd Street Y in New York City for a Q&A on Thursday, July 31st, following a sneak preview of my HBO special. Tickets for both shows are at WTFpod.com/tour. And one other thing, our old buddy, the great Eddie Pepitone, has a new special out starting today. It's called Eddie Pepitone, The Collapse. And you could get it at veeps.com. Yeah, just want to claw out of my body. And I'll bring that energy with me to the photo shoot for Men's Health. That'll be awesome. Just me hunched over, sucking in my stomach that I don't really have, but I feel like I have, but it's probably not real, but I can't tell because I have body dysmorphia and it doesn't matter. If I feel it, it's real, right? I know it's probably not real, but this is the only one that I really commit to. If I feel it, it's real. The flab, the chubs, the stuff hanging over. You can't really see it, but it doesn't matter. This is my issue. This is the one that stays. This is the one that stays. Fuck. Oh, my God. And then I had to take the cat to the vet today. I'm looking for new solutions for Charlie. So I had to take Sammy to the vet today just for a checkup. And it turns out Sam is a stocky little fucker, and he's pretty strong. And Sam and I, we get along fine, but he's a cat cat. He likes cats. He doesn't like me that much. He likes me okay, but it's very erratic and spontaneous and a little awkward when he shows affection. And I think he's kind of dumb, but you know, when he focuses, he's like, he can move. Like he's like all cat, but like just sitting around, he looks kind of dumb and he's kind of not mopey, but he always looks a little concerned. And you know, it's very awkward. I don't know if he likes to be touched or where to touch him. It's just, he's one of those cats, man. But he's tough, dude. Like, I had to take him to the vet. Also, like, very adventurous. He's the only cat, the once or twice I've left the door open, he's fucking out. He's not running around. He's just sort of like, dum-de-dum. What's going on out here? Dum-de-dum. But, look, I love Sam. We share space and we understand each other. And I think he's, I get a kick out of him. But I had to take him to the vet for a checkup, and I put the crate out. I've gotten a lot better at getting cats in crates since the fire, when I had to really, you know, man up to it and not fuck around. You know, you do need the focus. But I woke up to put him in the crate, and I put him in the crate, and that guy just like almost Herculean cat strength just bolted out of it. Like, I couldn't even grab him, but it was strong. It was surprisingly strong. And I'm like, well, fuck, there goes that vet visit. That's not happening. But about half an hour later, because he is kind of dumb, I think it was pretty far behind him already. And I just scooped him up and I put him in. And, you know, I had a towel in there and he's bitching and he's crying and he's kind of flailing around. It was like, God damn it. I've been doing this my entire adult life, bringing one fucked up cat or another to the goddamn vet and all the anxiety that that induces. And it kind of sealed the deal. I was going to take Charlie out to New Mexico with me when I go out there for a week, and just so he wouldn't be home causing trouble and beating up on my other cats and shitting or whatnot. But after this short ride with Sammy, I was like, fuck that, dude. I don't want to take him on the plane. I don't want to have to walk him through security. I have no idea. I ordered a carrier, a travel carrier, and I'll start trying to break Charlie in. But nonetheless, so I'm driving with Sam, and he's just, he's not howling, but he's not happy and he's all fucked up. And then like I smell shit in the car and I'm like, God damn it. So I got to pull over on the way and see if he's shit in the car, which means I got to reach in and hope he doesn't get out and start jumping around the car. I didn't have a fucking paper towel. So I got to pick up this lump of cat shit with my bare hands and throw it into the parking lot and then close up the goddamn cage and bring him to the fucking vet. It's so much drama and anxiety. It's amazing I didn't get killed on my way over there. But I've dealt with all of it. I've taken cats on planes. I've walked cats through security. I've driven them to vets. I've lost cats in the wild and gotten them back. I have freaked out about cats in every way possible. I've dealt with every cat disaster that's possible inside a house. I've put two cats down being in the room with them. I know it all. But God damn it, just driving a cat to the fucking vet, man. I was more worked up than Sammy was by the time we got there. And aggravated and already not feeling great in my body. But I get it, man. I am like the same fucking way. The amount of anxiety, aggravation, you know, just kind of like shitting my pants, not literally, before I've got to do something that seems scary or I'm not used to. I'm the same fucking way to the point where I don't even want to do it. Sammy didn't have a choice. I generally don't have a choice either. But you get right up to the edge of that. Where you're just sort of like, I want out of this fucking box of me. I'm going to shit right in my pants because of how fucking aggravated and frightened and fucking mad I am. I'll do that just to spite me. I don't want to fucking do this. And then you fucking do it and you're kind of even happy to be there. You know, it's nice. New experience, new environment, new people. And then, you know, you're on your way home. You're like, well, that wasn't so terrible. Then why? Why? Why put yourself through that shit, Mark? Why do it? This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. And our website, WTFpod.com, is also brought to you by Squarespace. It has been for years. And Squarespace makes it easy to make a beautiful website and get all the tools that'll help you engage with your audience. They have a completely new design system, Blueprint AI, and that's where you'll get started. Build your online presence from the ground up with a professional layout and style options. Then get to work on all the added features that will make your site a place where customers and fans can get everything they want. Make checkout seamless with simple but powerful payment tools. Set up a paywall to sell memberships or exclusive content. Even get access to stuff people can download right from the site. Go to squarespace.com/WTF for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the code WTF to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/WTF. Offer code WTF. Get started today. So look, Jenna Friedman, as I mentioned before, I've known her for years. Comedian, writer, producer. She'll be at the Edinburgh Fringe in Scotland with her show, Jenna Friedman, Motherfucker. That's August 8th through 24th. You can get tickets at jennafriedman.com.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
So I was telling you that, like, in this new special, not unlike the last one I did, I kind of had sections, and there was, like, 15 minutes up front that were specifically political. And what I was going to say, because you know, kind of swim in the same waters, is that an analogy?
Sure.
It's tricky to find a tone, especially if you want to come back from it, that is not slightly condescending and self-righteous.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah. So, how do I respond without sounding self-righteous and condescending?
But, you know, I had to kind of like figure it out. I had to work it out because I knew, not that necessarily I think that what I'm doing is for everybody, because it clearly is, but I, you know, given the state of politics and the amount of fear on behalf of vulnerable and, you know, left-leaning and even just Democrats or anybody, that, you know, you have to ground what you're doing in that community. And I think it's still for everybody, but you have to represent.
You're saying the audience, people are just fearful of what's going on right now.
Although they're terrified.
Yeah.
But like, because it's a special, you know, I want it to read that, you know, people aren't going to be like, oh, fuck this. You know, like whoever else, you know, no, I don't want to listen to politics or I don't like this guy.
Right.
So to find some just tonal middle ground, not material wise, but just a way of presenting that is a little more kind of like just a given as opposed to,
yeah,
was tricky.
Yeah.
Do you ever think about that?
I don't know. I think part of my problem is I don't think about that.
Oh, yeah.
I just kind of say what I want to say. I wish I thought about, I wish I was wired to think about the audience more.
Well, yeah, it's not like, obviously I'm not pandering kind of guy, but I did want it to, because I wanted to ease into this other part where I knew I was just going to be not so much lighthearted, but more focused on just like the comedy of a story that just hits. So I just decided to change the tone a little bit, to just make it more kind of like, hey, this is what's happening, as opposed to like, we're fucked and these guys, you know. There's a little of that in there.
I think, well, I haven't done a special in this moment. I think we're in a particularly challenging moment.
Yeah.
And I think your impulse is correct.
Yeah.
In terms of broadening out and not alienating people who might benefit from listening to you.
Sure. Yeah, but I said, look, I'm going to try to be entertaining now. I don't think it is necessarily the reason I started doing comedy, but I think I can.
Yeah.
And I did it. So it just, but I knew what I was up against, and I did take some pretty solid shots. But even
when you say solid shots, what do you mean? At politicians or at?
Well, like, without it becoming too, like, look, you've got all these talk show hosts who are doing one-liners about Trump or whatever. But to even talk in the arena that we're still in this sort of two-party situation that's resolvable in the old way, I think is it's not ignorant. And it's not even irresponsible. It's just stupid. That's all they know how to do. So instead of just mentioning names, I want to make sure this stuff has some legs. So it's not this dated thing hinged to a thing that happened.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I never thought it was him specifically. Yeah. It's everything that kind of enabled this moment to happen. It was so clear from, you know, I was on the campaign trail in 2015.
Yeah.
Working on a movie, and I saw him. I was seated behind him, actually. I was working on this silly movie with these guys called The Good Liars.
Yeah.
And we saw the moment, the New Hampshire primary, when he became like a viable political candidate.
Horrible moment.
It was really scary. Yeah. It was because, so I was in this movie, and it was a docu-style, unscripted comedy about these two guys who were pretending to be Trump supporters before Trump supporters were even really a thing.
Yeah.
It's okay. So before I even get into it, I'm actually like very in my head talking about Trump right now.
Yeah.
I think I posted about this, but I had a situation a couple weeks ago. Did you hear
at the
about
border?
It? Yeah.
In Canada? Yeah. Because I was, you know, I went to Canada after you and I was expecting something.
Yeah.
But nothing happened to me.
That's what a couple other people said. I know. It was my own fault. I was coming back and I had my guard down and I had offered up that I was a comedian.
This is American customs coming back into this
American
country.
Customs, yeah, right. But in Vancouver.
Right. No, yeah, I know that place.
I didn't know that American customs met you in Vancouver.
Yeah, they're on that. Yeah, they're all, it's easier, but like, yeah.
So I had my guard down. I thought it was literally just airport security asking me questions to make sure that I wasn't getting paid under the table or something.
And they were like, what were you doing up in Canada?
And I said I was there performing comedy at TED, which already sounds like a lie. And then he said, were you working or did you get, you know, and I just was like, no, it was unpaid, which is also a whole other issue.
Yeah.
And then he said, you're a comedian. And I said, yes. And he said, what do you joke about? And this is going to make me sound really stupid, but I'm fine with it. I actually said everything other than airport security. I just wasn't even thinking that he was
customs guy. Yeah,
and he didn't even react. He just kind of stared at me, And then he's like, what do you joke about? And I looked at his shirt and it said U.S. Customs.
Yeah.
And before I could respond, because I didn't know what I was going to say, he asked, do you make fun of politicians?
Yeah.
And I said no.
Uh-huh.
Because Trump's a businessman.
Yeah.
And he was like, go ahead. And he let me through. And it was this weird moment where I just thought, like, that's the craziest thing I've ever been asked.
Really?
As an American citizen with an American passport, going back into my own country.
But do you think, like, you know, you thought, you felt that his tone was that of policy and not curiosity? Do you know what I mean? Because, like, those guys, a lot of times they just want you to make a joke.
I don't think he was being flirty or jokey.
No.
I think he was literally just following orders. Also, that feels like a question. What if I had said yes?
To what?
Yeah, I joke about politicians. Is that illegal? What if I'd said that?
Well, I mean, I would have said it. Yeah, of course. What else are we going to joke about?
I don't know.
You felt like it was
I wanted
loaded.
To get home to my child. I had a flight to catch.
Yeah.
Because
I've been asked that. I don't know, like, you know, if I've been asked it specifically, like, what do you joke about? But I could see how in that moment and in the moment we're living in, that could feel like a threat.
Do you joke about politicians? I just channeled my, like, high school age self with my, like, coming home to my mom and being like, have you been drinking with your friends? And I was just like, no.
And interesting.
It didn't. That feels like a normal question.
Sure. I mean, sometimes they... It's a very weird stunted job, those guys, and you know they're devoid of personality, a lot of them, when you meet them, and also they have this you don't know what they're looking for, but I could see in the climate we live in that would seem like, you know, a check against you or whatever. But I've had them try to make conversations and it's never particularly fun. But sometimes I think it's just the nature of the personality of the job that makes them flat. And I'm not going to doubt your fear or what it implied.
I've been asked a ton of things going into other countries. I've never been asked questions going back into the country that I was born.
I understand. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe I was on edge. I was hanging out with like Carol Caldweller or whatever, however you pronounce her last name, one of the whistleblowers for Cambridge Analytica. And I just was like thinking about this a lot.
Look, there's no reason not to be paranoid, you know, and there's no reason, you know, but I mean, and now within the last week, he's going to investigate celebrities. But look, it's a scary time and there's no reason not to have that kind of fucking reaction to it.
Yeah.
But you're okay. You made it back.
No, I'm fine. It wasn't ever about me. I just felt like
they are changing.
Yeah, it felt like a scene in The Handmaid's Tale in a flashback.
Yeah.
It didn't feel... I fully understand my privilege. I wasn't afraid. It just felt ominous. The first thing I did after, I texted a friend of mine who doesn't look like Ann Romney. She's not white.
Yeah.
And she was also at TED. And I just said, just FYI, don't tell them you're a comedian.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I've always found that question in the past has been just their awkward way of making conversation. But it sounds a little different when it becomes specific.
Yeah.
How is the mother thing going?
How's the mother thing going? I don't identify as a mother. I feel like that term is...
Yeah.
No, I it's so weird. It wasn't something that I wanted. It just never... I got to like 39.
How old's the kid?
2.5.
Yeah.
The best. He's the best.
Yeah? What's his name?
I'll tell you.
Oh, okay.
He's the best. Yeah. He's so funny and cool, and I love him so much, and I'd feel so cliche, and I feel like I...
What do you mean you feel cliche?
Or just, I don't know.
Parenting changes people.
I mean, I don't know if it changed me or whatever, but I just feel very lucky.
And you love him.
I love him.
And you feel connected to him, and you miss him when you're away.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess I miss him, but I do love him. I've gone away from him a little bit, but yeah, I totally miss him. It's not even that I miss him. It's just like when I'm with him, my whole body feels like peaceful and calm.
When you're with him?
Yeah.
Oh, That's nice.
Yeah, he's just, he's
make
also,
sure you let him become his own person.
Of course. No, I understand. I understand the history of Jewish mothers and the burden
I'm
have.
I'm saying that as experience.
The cross to bear. No, I understand that. I
boundaries.
Understand that. I know.
But not yet.
No, not yet, but.
Yeah. Are you like, what is your mothering, what have you learned in terms of, because I don't have them. And
I don't have them either. I just have one.
No, I get it. But in terms of like the learning curve, like decisions you've made against your instincts, what are they? Do you know what I mean? Like sometimes I think whether it's overprotection or negotiating things that you should probably let them do on their own, that kind of stuff.
It's very hard for me to set boundaries.
Yeah.
He's the only man I've never, the only guy I've never been able to like say no to. I don't want him to be entitled. So I, you know, we give him like this little timeout where if he just, because two and a half, they're always pushing you. And so
yeah.
We have this little chair where he can like read a book in if he's really bad and just keeps, he's not bad. He's wonderful. But yeah. Like we've only put him in the chair twice.
That's the punishment?
Yeah, we'll put him in a chair.
The punishment like, chair?
Well, just the idea of being in timeout makes him sad. We're like, you can read a book in timeout, and we'll just put him in there for like 2 minutes.
Yeah.
It's just on principle we have to be like, you can't, if we tell you not to do something, you have to listen.
Yeah. Is it sinking in?
Yeah, he's really, really great.
Oh, good.
I don't know any other kids.
Yeah.
But he's awesome. And,
what do you mean you don't know any other kids?
I know his friends. You'll appreciate this. They all have names of like Jewish men from the 30s. They're all like Seymour, Sandy, Sydney.
Any Hymans?
Maury. No Hymans. My son is named Hyman. After
what?
I'm not even going to.
Yeah. It's too many steps to get back there.
I know.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I mean, at least you're adjusting to it, but you still don't like to identify as a mother necessarily.
I don't know. It's so complicated. I kind of feel, and did you just yawn?
No. I took a deep breath.
Oh, okay. Well, that's similar.
No, it's not.
Okay.
What is complicated about identifying as a mother? What do you think it takes away from you? I mean, I watched a special.
You watched Lady Killer?
Yeah.
Oof.
And that...
What?
Why are you saying it?
Did you like it?
Yeah, I like it. You know, look, you do a thing where you're like one time, the thing that, you know, that always sticks with me about when I did a half hour comedy special for HBO years ago, Jim Wolcott of The New Yorker, he said something like, you know, Marin is good, but he tends to hit the, I don't remember what the analogy was, like the fairground bell a little too much. Like there is a weight to, you know, how you do stand up and what you talk about. And, you know, as funny as it is, you know, it's still all pretty heavy.
Well, buckle up because that special is hard for me to watch.
Why? Because you're pregnant?
Mm-mm. So, I found out my mom was sick like the day before.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, and I there's a pocket knife here that I'm just going to focus on anytime I feel like I get emotional.
Sure, just don't use it.
I know.
On yourself or me.
it's such a like macabre object, so it's just centering me.
Mm-hmm.
But
the day before you taped, I found out
she was sick and
with
like
what?
Well, we didn't know it was pancreatic, but...
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
It's the worst one.
I know.
Yeah.
And so when I just...
You were holding in all that? I used to have Kleenex.
No, I don't want... I really don't like to cry in front of my coworkers, and it's so funny, because I can't... I watched Sarah Silverman's special.
Postmortem.
So good.
Yeah, it was great.
And... It reminded me, because so many people are doing stand-up comedy now, and then I look at Sarah, and I'm like, she's such a pro.
Yeah.
And she's so composed, and her jokes are just perfectly mapped out.
Yeah.
And I'm working on a new hour where I'm trying to excavate these feelings, and it's just been...
Of grief. How your mom passed away.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, she died like 6 weeks later.
Wow. That's fucking horrible. Well, I'm sorry for your loss. So when you watch that, it's not about the material also, pretty much, yeah, as much as what you were kind of keeping in.
Yeah. And the material, I'm proud of it. I didn't really get to workshop it as much as I'd wanted to because it was during COVID and I was 7 months pregnant.
Yeah.
But so there were a couple jokes, if you listen closely. There's one joke about, like, I also was shooting a true crime show at the same exact time, which is so funny to me. But because I was just, like, so pregnant and having to, like, read a crime scene.
Do you think you would have gotten pregnant if it wasn't COVID?
Oh, I know where you're going with that. We can talk about that.
I'm not going anywhere with it.
No, COVID fully domesticated me. I just come off of Edinburgh in 2019. I was about to tour my hour.
What was the name of that show?
Miscarriage of Justice. It was a political show. It did well in Edinburgh. Sorry, I can't pronounce it.
I can't.
And I was about to tour it, and then the pandemic happened. And then, yeah,
it's interesting how the Europeans like American political comedy much more than Americans.
Well, because it's like novelty to them, and they're so curious what is going. They don't. It's not as personal, and they don't have the fatigue that we have.
And also, they don't hear it from that side. I mean, what they're, you know, Europeans in relation to, you know, resistance and what they've been through, every country has been through at least two of these fuckers.
Right.
So, you know, the language of resistance is something they can lock into. But here, it's like, you know, these, why didn't they shut up? You know?
Right. We are so naive as a country. I mean, we're changing. It used to be that I would always do better in the UK because my comedy, more than political, is just dark. And they have a darker comedic sensibility than we do over here. But we're catching up.
It's gotten more political, I think, over time.
Yeah. But I just mean more. I don't even mean political. I just mean dark.
Yeah.
But yeah, in my special, there's like this one joke about, it's not funny, but I didn't realize that one of the leading causes, like the leading cause of death for pregnant women is homicide.
Huh.
Which I was like, where's the joke? But it's like the joke that ended up in the special is like, that's the male version of abortion, you know?
Right. Yeah.
I can't get an abortion. So, you know, it's not LOL, but it was funny to try to keep working it out. But I knew that if I'd had like a couple, like another month or two and just had been able to like work out this show, I would have gotten bits like that kind of.
LOL's tricky with politics, because it's like there's a difference between LOL and a laugh of recognition.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
But it's nice for you to say that, you know, that's politics. I'm just talking about murdered women. Murdered pregnant women. That to me is like dark, but it's also obviously political.
Yeah.
But not everybody sees it as political.
Well, I mean, you frame it politically in the special.
Right.
Yes, I do.
I do. I'm just trying to pretend I'm not a political comic.
Because
I want to be able to travel.
You want to be able to what? Go
get back into the country.
Oh, I thought you meant to tour.
You're
going to get back.
No, it's fine. I know.
Look, I'm not going to speculate about the nature of whatever this authoritarian shit show is going to eventually turn into. But I don't know. Like, I was thinking, so you're working on excavating and verbally processing your grief and the experience of.
Yes.
So
I have this new hour that I've been working out kind of since she died.
Where are you doing it? Dynasty and stuff?
I've been working out at Lyric.
Oh, yeah.
And then I've done a couple shows out of town.
So hard. It's so hard when you're dealing with, like, because when I was talking about Lynn, you know, fairly quickly after she passed away, you've got to sort of warn your audience that, you know, these emotions aren't processed yet. So I don't know why I did. And I was like, look, you know me. This is what I'm going through. I'm looking for the humor in terms of, and I do it on stage. You're more of a writer person. That, like, I find that if I get vulnerable on stage to a point where I can't handle it, I'll generally be funny. And usually that's how I generate it.
Do you cry? Have you cried on stage?
Yes. During that, definitely.
And how do you think people appreciated that vulnerability?
Well, I mean, you know, you said it in the last special. I mean, there is, you know, when with grief in particular, and even revisiting it after it's been some time, like if you get yourself into that place, those tears are very specific. Do you know what I mean? They're tears of loss. And I think that those are the kind of tears that can't be held back. So you're not crying because, you know, you're mad or a baby cries or, you know, or self-pitying or whatever. But grief is a universal experience. And a lot of people, they don't know how to share that. So I think that the crying is received in the way that humans are supposed to receive it.
Yeah. I was doing the show and I was blowing past the sad parts and I was able to just do the show. And then I talked to a comedian friend whose father died when he was 22.
Yeah.
And I asked, you know, how long did it take you to like not cry all the time? And he said it took like 5 to 7 years. Because I feel kind of weird that I can't
talk about it without crying. Yeah, but it's like, what I tried to do in relation to that was the way I framed it in my head, especially because, you know, she died so out of the blue and tragically and quickly. And, you know, she was young, is that, you know, I'm not the victim, she is. You know, what I'm experiencing is loss. And there's really nothing unusual about loss. It is as human as, you know, birth and death and all of that. It's just we don't have a cultural dialogue around it, really. Or a way of emoting.
I would say that you are the victim. That she's out. Like you're the victim. The people who loved her are the victims.
No,
she's gone.
I don't see them as victims. I feel like somebody being taken out of life tragically and quickly in a surprising way.
I'm not saying she's not the victim. I'm just saying you're also.
Yeah, I didn't see it as victimness because and that was very helpful for me to put in place very early on. I just tried to frame it as like. Look, I lost somebody. That is not it's not a victim position. It's a human position,
right?
And also to know in my heart that there's nothing unusual about this, zero,
right?
That this is a human experience that no one can get out of life not experiencing it. Everyone deals with loss.
Yeah,
it's guaranteed. It's the only thing that's guaranteed.
Yeah.
So on that level, you know, despite the fact that. You know, we don't know what to do with the feelings or we're embarrassed or, you know, when you have uncontrollable feelings, it's too vulnerable, especially in public. But the truth is, if more people do that, we've had some language around this. And it's actually fairly politically righteous to accept death and embrace grief and feel those feelings because the entire capitalist system is driven by avoiding death or denying it.
Also, like... robots aren't going to replace someone who's just crying on stage. Yeah.
Well, we should do some research on that. I'm sure that they've got some pretty sophisticated crying robots now. And I'm not sure there's not a lot of people on TikTok who aren't, you know, for all intents and purposes, you know, robots who cry.
Right. AI chatbots and.
Or just people. You know, people who like.
Oh, correct.
You know that their shtick is the vulnerability racket.
Yeah.
But anyways, well, I'm sorry for your loss, and it's okay to cry. So, how are you doing with the processing? How long has it been now?
A little over 2 years. I mean, it's fine. I just, I'm going over there. I'm nervous about doing the show, and.
Going over where?
To Edinburgh.
Oh, you're going there again. You said, that's right. You told me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you don't have the show fully in place, but, you know, you got a little wiggle room with Edinburgh.
Yeah.
I'm working it out.
It's 90% there.
Yeah. Oh,
and,
good.
And I'm heading over. I'm going to do 18 shows in August. I know. Yeah. I know.
Are they produced or are you just going there on your own? You got to run around, hand out flyers and stuff.
I'm not going to have to do
okay,
that.
Okay, good.
Thankfully.
Yeah.
But I probably will.
I met you in Scotland, I think.
Yeah.
Glasgow.
Yeah, that town is crazy.
Glasgow?
I remember at the stand seeing there was like a hen party, and that's a bachelorette party. Or maybe they stopped having those or something.
In Glasgow?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But people, the woman got so drunk that she fell and knocked down like the whole table with her. And people just laughed. And...
Oh, there was more public vomiting than I'd ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
In that place. It's so funny because what I remember about that trip was, you know, trying to talk you into going to business school.
What? I don't remember that at all.
That was the entire fucking
time. You were trying to tell me to go to business school.
No, we were walking around and, you know, I watch your show and I don't know how.
You watched me do stand up and then you told me wanted to.
No, you didn't know what to do. You were trying.
I was really young.
What, no, but you're trying to figure out because you got into Brandeis or somewhere.
Yeah, this is someone else.
No, it's not. You were like literally like, I don't know if I should pursue this or pursue business. I mean, we talked about it for a
while. Oh, I got into UCLA Film School, but that wasn't then.
I don't know. We talked about it a
lot.
I
didn't apply to business school.
Well, you did not know if you wanted to stick with stand-up.
Really?
Yes. I don't know how old you were, but it was like you were like it was you just didn't know if it was the right. I think you were just nervous about the security element.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. But it was like on your mind.
Of course. Until and, you're making money doing comedy, you're well, yeah, but thinking I just, about making money doing comedy.
That's right. So but I just remember the conversation and I was sort of like, well, maybe, you know, you shouldn't do it.
Cool.
It wasn't because of your stand up. I don't even think I'd seen it yet.
Oh, that's cool.
I don't even know like how we knew each other at that time.
I remember performing at a show with you and you were on the same show and it was a basement show at a bar and there were like 10 people there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember that too. Vaguely.
Yeah.
And I remember we walked around a cemetery.
Oh, probably. I love cemeteries.
Yes, a big cemetery there.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. And then, you know, I just remember that you were just unsure, but you would have been. It was just at the beginning.
Yeah. You had just started doing
The podcast.
Yeah.
So crazy.
Yeah.
So long ago.
Yeah.
And you're happy you chose the career you chose.
Yeah. You're such a dick.
I'm really not a dick. You want to make me a dick.
I don't want to make you a dick.
You just want to make me a dick.
I don't want to make you. No, you've evolved. You've evolved.
I'm not.
You're not a dick. You're a veteran of, you're a wise.
Oh, come on. So, but like, let's go through so people know because you're not necessarily.
Nobody knows
no,
you.
No one knows who you are, Jenna. And that's not being a dick. You say it yourself.
They do at my business school.
Your secret business school?
Yeah.
But what did you do? You didn't go into USC?
I got Letterman.
I got into
UCLA.
Right.
Film school.
Yeah.
And then I got Letterman.
Out of New York.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when you were, that was like 2010, 2011?
Yeah.
How did that go? How'd you get that?
So I had, I think it was Jeff Garlin I opened for him, and David Miner saw me.
Oh, right.
And then they submitted me. I sent in a packet. I didn't hear back. And then a year later, they asked me to submit again. I submitted something overnight.
Yeah.
And then I went in for the interview, and they'd asked me, have you ever written for anyone? And the only person I just wrote some roast jokes for Jeff Ross.
Yeah.
And I realized I'd never had a job. How do you get hired if you don't have a job? And I just said, I wrote some roast jokes for Jeff Ross.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize this would happen, but they called Jeff immediately, and Jeff sang my praises, and I got hired that day.
That's crazy.
I know.
But I remember, like, because there was a period there where we were friends until I decided that you were being condescending to me.
You were so mean. It's okay.
But it was a misunderstanding. You didn't think I was as insecure as I was.
I didn't think you were. I didn't think, my mistake, I didn't realize that you can be older and not be mature.
Yes.
You were twice my age, and I just thought you were wise and would be.
Not twice your age.
Well, not anymore.
Okay.
Not twice, fine, 20 years.
Okay, fine. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you didn't realize that you could be a neurotic, immature, insecure person at my age at that time.
Yeah, like 46
Who would meet his friend who he met in Edinburgh, and she was telling him about all his successes, her successes, and you didn't even fathom the idea that I could be like, oh, fuck. I got nothing going on.
It wasn't my. That's how you heard it. I think I was having
course.
A hard time at it.
I know, and I feel bad
Letterman.
For it now. You were, and that was another part of my brain. It's like, yeah, but you're Letterman.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I was just like, yeah.
You were getting opportunities I never ever got. But yeah, I apologize for that.
Thanks
for being immature.
That's okay.
And you know, and defensive, but I do remember because we went to the Chelsea restaurant, and that place isn't there anymore. That was the best. That place that was open like all night, like it was on like, you know what I'm talking
14th?
About? Yeah.
Yeah.
But so how long did you stay over there?
In New York?
In Letterman.
A year. And then there was a job, a field producer job at The Daily Show.
But was it rewarding? I mean, did you feel like that was the trajectory that you were meant to do?
No, I mean, it was so weird because by the time I got there, it was like Weekend at Bernie's. He was just like
checked
going,
out.
Yeah, totally just going through the motions. Yeah. There was just a lot of politics.
Yeah.
And I didn't work with him at all. So it's hard to, you know, I got a lot of top tens on and a lot of like the things that we would submit on, just like the kind of one-liners.
Yeah.
I was successful getting those on, but it was just, and everybody was so demoralized. At one point, I remember being 9 months in and they would call these like emergency top 10 meetings where like, Dave didn't like any of the top 10s. We had to start all over. And everybody was running around and it was so stressful. And I just giggled because it felt so silly to me that it's not an
You weren't in the culture.
You know what I mean? Like we're not like,
that's funny.
Someone's not dying.
And you weren't in the culture long enough to realize the cult of personality.
I just didn't. And so I was laughing and I said something, I think it was Jeremy Weiner, and he's like, I was like, it's so, I don't know what I said, but Jeremy looked at me, he's like, you're part of us. You've been here for 9 months. You're not.
Yeah. You're not an outsider.
An outsider.
Yeah.
And it just was, but everybody there was so nice. And it's so surreal, all these opportunities that you get because.
And then how'd The Daily Show happen?
Wyatt Cenac, who I knew in stand-up, said that there was a field producer role open.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what that was. I said, I'm a comic. It's not for me. And he, to his credit, was like, don't be an idiot. This is it'll teach you, you know, you're right, basically a writer-director in the field. And I submitted for the job. I did this trial piece. And I got it. And to this day, that was one of the best jobs I've ever had. John was a great boss, and I learned how to write and direct field segments.
How long were you there?
3 years. I left when John, I only wanted to like stay for one just because I just really was like a comic. And and then I ended up staying until John retired from the show.
So it's interesting that like, so you got these opportunities when you're like in your early 20s.
Yeah.
And so the fact of them, yeah, see, that would have been, you know, another mistake I would have made in my immature mind was that it wasn't really about ambition even. It was just about sort of having people recommend you and you're like, why wouldn't I do this?
My whole career has been pretty scattered and I just kind of, I take opportunities as they come and I try to make the most of them.
Well, yeah, but that one for The Daily Show really kind of paid off in terms of what you wanted to do with your life.
Yeah, I mean, the two shows that I had on the air that were my own would not have been as good as they were if I hadn't learned how to field produce.
Well, what was that one that you did with Kronberg?
Oh, that was a web series. That was
Was that during The Daily Show or after?
Before, I think. Before and during.
And what was the angle on that web series?
I had seen a New York Times wedding video that looked so silly, and I just parodied it.
Yeah.
And it was during wedding season, and we didn't say that it was a parody, so people thought it was real, and so it went viral.
Did you get in trouble?
Yeah, they sent me a cease and desist letter. So we had to put, like, parody. But to me, it was so clear that it was a parody.
Yeah.
And people just, I always overestimate people, I think.
Oh, yeah. People are dumb.
Yeah, I didn't realize.
Even smart people are dumb.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of amazing. Some of the
I think we all got the memo now in this current moment.
Yeah.
I'm not doing that anymore.
But I think what happens is that you can't, you know, you're dumb only because you can't adapt. Like, you know, there's a lot of things that make people dumb. It's like, you know, shifting to Gmail. And then you expect like, you know, old people.
I haven't done that. Yeah. I have a Yahoo mail.
So like, and then just like, I know from having a podcast for years and just having people after a certain age, like, I don't understand. Where do I get it? I'm like, on your phone.
Mm-hmm.
It's two clicks. Did you ever have to go through an old person's phone? Your mom's?
It's fine.
It's okay. But like my mom's boyfriend before he lost his mind, like he wanted me to do something on his phone and he literally had, I think, 1,000 open windows.
Right. I actually have that. I have 1,000 open. And that's me.
I don't like when my email has numbers.
Right. I understand that.
It's fucking annoying.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at Michaela Watkins' phone one time and she had like 1,100 unopened emails. I'm like, what are you doing? You can't have that number there.
Right.
I don't know. So what were the shows that you did on your own? I can't remember. There's one for Adult Swim.
Yeah. Yeah, it was called Soft Focus. And I just feel so lucky that we were given the opportunity to make that show.
Yeah.
I wish that those opportunities still existed.
Don't they exist in terms of self-generating?
Yeah.
It just seems like everybody's just starting their own show business.
Everyone's doing their own thing. You have to, yeah.
Yeah. And what was that show?
It was a couple specials. We were about to shoot a third one, and then the pandemic happened, but it ran. I did it in like 2018 and 2019.
Wow, the pandemic really fucked you on so many levels.
No, I mean it. It turned me into a mom. Yeah,
exactly.
It's great. No.
And wasn't there one other one?
Yeah, and then I had a true crime show, which is crazy how that.
Are you a true crime freak?
No, I was making fun of true crime on Conan. I was making fun of true crime. And this industry is such a cash cow that they were like, let's, you know, like, do you want to do a show? And so I did like a little kind of development deal with AMC Plus, and then I got a show off of it. And
how many episodes did you do?
2 seasons.
Oh, that's pretty good. Of how many?
Only 12 episodes.
Okay.
6 episodes each season. And it was intense. It was really intense, and I'm very proud of what we were able to do.
Yeah.
And we infused some comedy into it, which I didn't think would be possible. But yeah, I mean, it was cool to, there was one specific episode about this girl whose grandmother was murdered.
Yeah.
Allegedly, okay. Allegedly murdered by this guy. And then the guy checked himself into a mental hospital, called like a billboard defense attorney who convinced the jury that this woman had choked on his dick. And then he got away with it.
Yeah.
And then not only was she murdered, she was made a punchline in the media because, of course, you know, granny chokes on dick.
Yeah.
And so, and being a comedian, you're handed a story like this, and people think it's easy. It's actually the most complicated story to make funny because it's like, you don't want to do dick jokes. You know what I mean? And you're like, how do I
balance it?
What do I do? And so, I'm very proud of that episode because we were able to make a show that really reframed the narrative. I was worried about, will this episode be an ad for the defense attorney to get him more work if we do it wrong? And we got this grizzled veteran cop on, and she was like, everybody knows when it's like a sex crime, like you just blame the victim. That's what you do. It's called like the rough sex defense or the consent defense.
Oh, yeah.
And it was really cool. And then I ended up talking to the defense attorney. He sat down with me.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know how you prepare for interviews. I want to ask you next.
Okay.
I'm curious as to your process, but I really, a lot of times with interviews like that, I'll do a lot of research and I ask questions, and then a lot of it is like improvised. And in this, I was just trying to talk to him, but in this moment I just was like, you know, have you ever sucked a dick? And he was like, well, I don't know if I can answer that. And I was like, sorry to slut shame you, that's the defense attorney's job. And it really just kind of like got hit home, like what the kind of point was about. We also had a medical examiner on to say that like you can't die that way, like that's not an actual way to die. And also in the UK, consent defenses or rough sex defenses are illegal. You can't present them in court because they're just not you can't like accidentally kill someone during sex in that way. But they're still legal in the US. So it did feel like a little bit that, like, kind of, without sounding like self-righteous, like that advocacy comedy where you're like, hey, if we just knew that these were defenses, maybe we could outlaw them in states where they're just used to exonerate abusers or give them murderers or give them reduced sentences.
Yeah. So that's good. That's a great piece of work.
I know. And then the show, and then, we just ran for 2 seasons. And I think.
Is that episode available somewhere?
Yeah. I mean, I can send it to you. Yeah.
What about for the people that are listening?
For the people that are listening, I can send it to you too. For the two guys jerking off to my lisp, I can send it to you too.
That's not my audience. But it's a lot of concerned, aggravated women.
Oh, I love you. I love women.
So that was one of those things where the style of the Daily Show interrogation, because you got to have some, you know, balls
yes.
to do that.
Yes.
And know you're going to do it. So the type of interviewing I do is not comparable to that.
How do you prepare for your interviews?
Well, for somebody like you, who I know for a long time, you know, I hope that we can, you know, connect as people. Like when I do these, my only hope is that I'll figure out in my mind some portal in, you know, that will either become thematic or not, but at the very least develop a genuine rapport that then can just move on its own. You know, I try to know as much as I can about people, but a lot of times it's not about what they're promoting or anything else. It's whether a real conversation happens. So that's all I'm looking for. I don't have questions generally, unless it's somebody with a huge amount of work that they've done out of respect. You don't want to diminish someone who's a master of something.
Right.
So, but generally I have to like the person.
Right.
And then, you know, hopefully it turns into a conversation.
Right.
That's my thing. Like, but for doing that kind of stuff, you have to know, like, I'm going to do this question now.
Yeah. You have to know. You have to know how to, I mean, at the Daily Show, we basically would go out with a script beforehand. And you, a good example was, there was a really tricky piece. Sam B was a correspondent.
Yeah.
And it was on the fast food worker strikes.
Right.
All my pieces were pretty heavy. I got there at a point when John was just like, whatever you want to, whatever you care about, we can find a way to make it funny. And that has been my mantra ever since. I really do feel like you can kind of make anything funny.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to do a piece about like income inequality and fast food worker strikes. But it's like in 4 minutes, you're trying to like make a case against like free market capitalism.
Right.
That's actually funny. How do you do that?
Yeah.
And we found this guy, this hedge fund guy who had been on the show. I think he predicted or he helped predict like the 2008 crash. So he really liked John. And we asked him a series of questions. And one of the questions that Sam asked was, do you believe markets determine wages? Yes. Okay. Yeah. Question, next question. Describe to me the type of person worth $2 an hour. And he said, I don't know what the PC term for R word is.
Uh-huh.
And he said that on camera.
Yeah.
And we aired it.
Yeah.
And that then became the crux of the piece. Like, it wasn't haha funny, but it was like, this is what we're talking about. This is why we don't want to live in a society where, like, your people are what they're worth.
You know,
you're having disabled people worth $2 an hour. Do you want to live in that type of society? Because, like, that's what free market capitalism with no regulations is. I'm not, like, a Marxist. I'm just saying that was how we were able to.
That's great.
You know, articulate a point of view using either humor or just kind of hypocrisy or whatever you want to call it.
Well, when you, in terms of activism, which I think you do, was this something you grew up with? Like when you were in college, you know, what was your disposition?
Yeah, I mean, I was an anthropology major. I mean, I got into comedy the least funny way possible. I wrote a paper about it. It's so lame. It's so lame. I wrote like my...
Could you send that over to me too?
Yeah. No, I wrote a paper about comedy and that's how I got into it. It was like I have
what
a book
the,
out.
What was the thesis?
I wrote about this in a book. So I have it. So it is out there if people are interested.
It's a chapter in a book mm-hmm. of yours. What's the book called?
Not Funny. Yeah. Okay. I also like, I know that... Okay.
What?
I titled the book Not Funny because I wanted to get a foreword by someone named Bill Cosby who wasn't Bill Cosby.
Yeah.
I thought that that would be funny.
Yeah.
And I found someone.
Yeah.
And he wrote a foreword.
Yeah.
And
who was that guy?
Just a random guy named Bill Cosby. Okay. I had closed my Facebook account. I had to reopen Facebook and friend a bunch of Bill Cosbys to find. It took me so long to track down somebody who would do this.
Yeah.
His name was William Cosby.
Okay.
Anyway, my editor rightfully nixed the idea.
Oh, after all that work.
Yeah, it's fine. But so I think Not Funny forward by Bill Cosby really sells that the book is funny.
Yeah.
But just Not Funny as a title. I'm into it, but it feels more like diatribe than I wanted.
It was just essays?
Yeah.
And your paper.
It wasn't the paper. So the paper, there is an essay about how I wrote this paper.
Oh,
I did like an ethnography of Improv Olympic. That's how I got into comedy. I went to Improv Olympic. I showed up. I wanted.
Could you define ethnography for me?
It's like a year. It's a research paper in a community.
Okay.
So in anthropology, and I talk about this and that, but a lot of anthropology is like the ethnographic method where you study a community.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is really problematic because you had like white people going over to foreign countries to study these indigenous populations and then like misinterpreting all their customs
with a colonial point of view.
Right.
Yeah.
So I wanted to study a community that I could actually assimilate into.
Okay.
And I was living downtown, and this comedy theater was around the corner from me. I originally wanted to study women in stand-up in Chicago. Yeah. And at the time, I was told there weren't that many. And there were. They just weren't, like, on the north side. There was, like, Patty Vasquez.
Yeah.
But there weren't a lot of women doing stand-up comedy at the time. And so somebody said, you should check out Improv Olympic.
Yeah.
And I went there, and I just fell in love. And that was, like, my gate. I just wanted to see classes. I was like, can I pay for a month pass to see classes? And Katie Rich, who went on to, I don't know if you've ever talked to her, but she's hilarious and wrote for SNL.
Yeah.
She was working the door, and she's like, well, if you sign up for classes, you can see all the shows for free. It's a cult.
Yeah.
And I started to do that, and I was sold. And so I kind of fell in love with this community where you could be your own writer, director, performer. Have you ever done improv?
No, not on that level.
Thinking of you doing improv makes me laugh.
Yeah. I've been dragged into improv situations.
Yeah, no.
But I've not done it like as a collaborative form.
It also always, every time I've seen it in LA, it has lost its shine. I don't know if it's because I've gotten older and I've been doing comedy, but when I started doing it in Chicago, it was before improv was a punchline. It was before The Office and all these shows that utilized improv kind of went mainstream. And I couldn't believe this was a thing that people did.
Well, I think it's like, you know, from talking to hundreds of people that, you know, a way into comedy as, you know, a writer, performer, producer, director, that, you know, stand-up was kind of sidelined years ago. I mean, I think that you get a more well-rounded person and a less socially aggravated person, you know, out of collaborative theater work.
Yeah.
And the type of people that gravitate to it, in my experience, are a little better off as humans.
Yeah.
Than the gypsies that are, or I guess you can't use that word anymore, the kind of wandering solo weirdos that are comics.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the paper ended up getting me. So I let somebody publish the paper on a comedy website. It circulated, and Sharna Halpern basically blacklisted me from IO.
Oh my God.
And
why?
That's how I got into stand up.
She blacklisted you
because the paper was
from IO.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because the paper was, it was so benign, it was so tame, but I was looking at improv. This is going to sound so wonky, but I like improv was kind of like a lens to view social inequality. And so I was looking at Improv Olympic, and I'm like, this place has made such great strides in the past 20 or 30 years. Tina Fey and Amy Poehler are hosting SNL. Predominantly white middle-class women are achieving equality in this community, but everybody else is lagging behind.
Uh-huh.
It's not because improvisers are racist. It's because there are like systemic issues in our like larger political economy.
Okay.
Everything we're talking about now, I mean, I really saw it there. At the time that I was there, there were like, I had friends who were non-white performers who kind of got pushed out of the mainstream and had their own improv groups. It was like, it felt like separate but equal, which isn't equal. In Chicago at the time, you had like all, and like a couple all black improv groups, like Latino, all Asian improv groups. People were just like finding separate communities because the mainstream was so hostile to them.
Interesting. Yeah.
So I wrote about that. I also wrote about how like it's a bar, it's a work environment, it's an educational center. Lines are blurred. When I was an intern, I had so many experiences, and I wrote about the most benign one, which was just like, it was so benign. I just thought it was funny. I was reading about sexual harassment, and like one of the male teachers came up and like rubbed my lower back and like told me my hair looked really cute or something.
Yeah.
And I was like, that was what I wrote about. What actually happened was crazy. Not to me, but just in general, it was a crazy environment. And so, but just because I said, hey, this environment could be sexually charged and that's not really helpful or conducive to people trying to be there to learn, people got very upset. And I had a show that was canceled. I got kicked off my Herald team. And
really?
And then like the Reader wanted to do a story about it, and I was so ashamed and embarrassed. I just was like, I don't want to make waves that way.
How did the other improvisers take it? Were you like ostracized at all levels?
Well, the only people that really came down on me were like two of my favorite female teachers. I wrote about it. I've written about it.
Because what were you were saying from an outsider or even an insider point of view in the context that you were saying it, it implied something about them that they didn't think was true and may not have been true.
I used all pseudonyms. I didn't say anything about them. I think one of them apologized to me years later. I think I just like I'm this random 20-something early, like 20-year-old coming into this community kind of saying like, this is the stuff that happens. Like nobody
but it was
wants
so specific.
That person.
If you hadn't let them publish it, it would have just been a paper you wrote for school.
Yeah, I know. I didn't let them publish it. It was just a comedy blog. It was like new blogs were new.
Yeah, yeah.
See. It was just. And then the interesting thing is that like in 2015, all this stuff came to light. Like all the sexual harassment there, like all these people, someone complained about sexual harassment and Sharna was like, I'll fix it by offering you free classes. Uh-huh. And it, all this stuff came to light. And I was like, they knew about this. I mean.
Oh, see, you got them where it hurt.
It's not there. It's not any organization's fault. It's just.
Happens.
It happens. And it's like, how do we, no one's perfect, but it's just like these places are so special. When they're, I mean, there's, I don't know, I really, it felt like a magical place and it's such a bummer that people can't take constructive criticism.
They should grow up.
I just, you know, I wasn't saying anything really controversial. It would have been cool if they were like, okay, we read this, maybe teachers shouldn't try to fuck students. Like, I don't know, that's all. You know, like maybe we should just kind of like be careful about that.
Yeah. Instead they threw you out. And then made you a stand-up.
And that made me a stand-up.
And you stayed in Chicago.
I went to New York. I had a play that I wrote that was critically panned in Chicago. And then I took it to New York and it did really well. And then I was like, I'm moving to New York.
What was that one called?
It was a satire on American Girl dolls as refugees.
Oh, yeah.
It was this. And I had my cast were all these incredibly talented women in Chicago. And it was such a cool experience. And it really taught me about satire.
But it's interesting that coming out of anthropology that, you know, that one paper in terms of, you know, understanding your place as a woman, as a creative person, you know, that's always been the active part of your creativity.
I guess so.
That's good. Well, at least, you know, you've stuck by it.
Yeah.
You have a voice.
Nah. Yeah, my mom used to say, you have a voice. People might not listen, but you have a voice. Yeah.
And so when did you move out here? I had no idea you lived here.
I was going back and forth. And then the pandemic, I was like, you know what? LA doesn't, it's not looking so bad.
Yeah, New York got hit very bad.
People,
very hard.
My New York friends were like, I love New York. I will always be a New Yorker in my heart. And I try to get back there as much as I can. But I do think during the pandemic, there was a little bit like, we're going to stay here. And I'm like, do you understand when a system's under stress? Same thing with the LA fires. If you have the privilege and ability to get out, to put less stress on the system, do it.
Right.
Do it. That helps everybody.
Yeah.
Don't bash people for leaving, you know, I mean, I don't know. That's my point of view.
No, I get it. But did you grow up in New York?
Yeah, from New Jersey.
Jersey?
Yeah, all comedians.
Yeah. What part of Jersey?
Haddonfield, next to Philly and Cherry Hill.
Oh, down there.
Down there.
Yeah.
You're from New Jersey, too?
Well, I was born there. My family's from there. You know, I didn't spend
where were
any
they,
formative
where were you born?
Time. I was born in Jersey City.
Oh, okay.
But my, like, I think most of it was, you know, Pompton Lakes. I think it's Bergen County, you know, Wayne. We lived in Wayne, New Jersey. It's definitely about 45 miles outside the city, not by Philly. Mm-hmm. But I got family down the shore and shit, you know. I've said it many times. I'm genetically Jersey. Mm-hmm. So you just came out here for the pandemic.
I pandemicked. Yeah, no, I was also working. I worked on Roseanne.
Oh, yeah.
For a day.
Yeah.
Then she sent out that tweet.
That was the end of that gig?
No, it became the Connors, and I worked on that for a year. And then I work with Sasha. I've been working with Sasha out here.
Oh, that's right. You did the second Borat movie?
Mm-hmm.
What's that like? How does that process work?
Sasha.
Like, what'd you do on the... So I guess the skill set around... Produce segments on The Daily Show again kind of helped you.
Yeah, yeah. I knew how to pitch for what he does.
Yeah.
Because I did that. I produced those things.
Yeah.
I think from my Adult Swim show, I think he'd seen some of my segments, and that's how I got into his orbit. And then, yeah, Borat 2 was a dream. I mean, because for years I've wanted to make kind of shocky, feminist, creepy comedy, and there wasn't the platform, and then Sasha was totally game.
Yeah, I did a cartoon with Maria, what's her name?
Bakalova.
Yeah.
She was so good. I don't know, did you see that movie?
Yeah.
So the period dance.
Yeah.
That was...
That's from the mind of Jenna Friedman.
There was more to it that got cut for time, but Maria's literally doing somersaults with like a bloody underwear all around Sasha. And whenever I feel sad, I just think about that and laugh. It's the funniest. I feel so lucky that I got to be part of that. It's like the dream. I mean, especially as like a female comic of my generation, but it's like you never talked about period stuff. You knew not to. It wasn't a thing.
Yeah.
And then to really just be able to go there in this way.
To end all the conversation.
And it's also like no one can tell you that. I love the type of comedy when no one can tell you something's inappropriate because you're like, but these are natural and like half the population goes through with this. So what's inappropriate about it? You know, like when you kind of.
Responding to the stereotyping of female comics is, well, you just talk about their period. That kind of
thing. I think that's what I'm responding to. Yeah.
So like it's fun when you can find a way to go so far over the top that, you know, you end the conversation.
Yeah. Yeah.
So where now tell me like, because we'll probably air this. When you're heading over there to Scotland, the arc of this thing, did you find that you were able to counter your feelings of grief with comedy all the way through?
I'm figuring it out. It's really fun. Like when I get, I don't know if this will be in the final show, but whenever I feel sad, because I think the show is better when I connect to the material.
Yeah.
But then I don't know how you feel, but it feels like, if I feel sad, I don't want to cry because that feels like hacky or it feels like fraudulent or something. It feels like, I don't know. I have a hang up about that.
Well, can you do it on purpose?
Well, here's the thing. When I think about my mom, I can cry at the drop of a hat.
Right.
And then if anyone's like, oh, she's being what I'm like, look at my IMDb page. Clearly, I'm not an actor. You know, clearly I can't cry on command.
Right. No, I don't think there's, I understand.
I don't know why I have that, like, I feel like it's disingenuous or something, because I've seen so many shows where people cry.
Yeah.
And it just, there's just something about it, so.
You should open the show with that, like a sort of like a trigger warning, that there may be real tears.
So I just did the Soho Theater, and they have all these trigger warn, like.
In London?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The triggers now, it's a different time. I don't think we should have. I don't think that we should need trigger warnings for shows. I think we do people a disservice when
I don't think so either. But I think it's a joke.
As a joke,
to sort of counter your fear of crying as being misinterpreted as doing something manipulative.
Right. Well, I have other jokes. Okay. No, I mean, So whenever I get sad, now I have a prop. Like right now, I have a prop flashlight that I just shine on, like just a random man.
Yeah.
To just kind of like take me out of my.
Oh, okay.
And also, like, feel like British men are so repressed that to be like, no, you're crying.
It just kind of gets me out of it. That's funny. Yeah.
Yeah, I've done it a couple times. I don't know if that'll stay in, but it's just a good clutch to have.
Now, where are you on this sort of like, because I feel that, do you feel that you were able, like, you're obviously continuing with what you're doing, but do you feel that, was there ever a point where the writing was cutting into what you thought was stand-up time?
Ask that again.
I mean, like, a lot, because, like, you know, I'm a stand-up, all the way through and through. So, like, anything else, even when I started the podcast, I'm like, yeah, but I'm a stand-up. You know, like, there was always this sort of, even if it was making me money, which it wasn't, but when people began to know me as this guy, which gives
podcaster
me a lot.
Podcaster Mark Maron.
Well, a broader personality that I wasn't, you know, and was freeing for me. But I always see myself as a stand-up, no matter what. And, you know, that, and I come from sort of this weird warrior mindset about it. And I just wondered, do you feel like you've been able to put as much time into stand-up as you want?
Because I'm a mom?
Just in general, because you had all these writing jobs.
No, I haven't. Especially now. I mean, being in LA, it's so much harder to do stand-up. It is hard when you have a kid. Like, I'm going to be away from him for 3 weeks, which I haven't been, which feels weird because he's growing so fast.
Yeah.
My husband's a musician, and he also, as a performer, understands he's like, because I was like, can you guys come over? And he's like, you're not going to want us there. You just focus on I'm doing a show every day at like 4 p.m. He's like, just focus on your work. Focus on the show.
Yeah. And he's a solid dude.
Yeah, he's great.
Good.
And
it'll be good. It'll be good for you.
Yeah. But I mean, stand-up's so labor intensive. So I know that when I'm in New York and I'm doing like 3 shows a night, I'm funny.
Yeah.
And when I'm not, like the last time I performed at the Cellar, I hadn't performed there for months. I haven't performed in like a couple weeks.
Yeah.
And I just had a rusty set in front of Esty.
Isn't that funny that it all comes down to Esty?
It all comes down to Esty. but yeah, I mean, it's, I've dipped into the Comedy Store a little bit out here, but it's just, if I'm not doing stand-up frequently, I get rusty really quickly.
Yeah, you lose that connection, the audience connection. Like if you're, it's like a gym. Like if that's open, if you're doing that 2-3 nights a week, so it stays open. If you go like 3 weeks, you're like that part, you have to reintroduce yourself to it.
Yeah, it's crazy how labor intensive it is.
Yeah, it takes time, but it's good that you're working on like one piece.
Yeah.
I think Sarah handled that very well, to do the one piece. And like, and that framework is, you know, you can go anywhere with it, with grief, because you can go back to all of your experiences with your mother and then to where it becomes kind of daunting and horrible.
I don't talk about, I mean, I probably could put more of her in it. I just, the experience of losing her, it all happened in my third trimester.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
So I was like 27 weeks pregnant. And I was like, la-di-da. And then like the day before I taped the stand-up special, I found out that she was sick. And I didn't know how sick because nobody was telling me anything. And then I was also shooting the true crime show at the same time. So I was just running around shooting this show about like murder. And then she died like 5 or 6 weeks later. I had to fly back to say goodbye to her at 34 weeks pregnant. But I went,
and that kind of hung over your birth.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I did not want kids. I still am ambivalent about kids, but I love my one kid, and it was something I didn't want, and my husband really wanted it.
Yeah.
And I was just like, you know what? You can go ahead and try.
Yeah.
I've never been pregnant. Probably won't get pregnant this time. And it happened like right away.
Yeah.
And I feel so lucky about that because my mom got to see me be pregnant.
Right.
And he has also been like such an antidote to grief.
Right.
But I was a mess, and there was comedy to be had in being like such a mess. I was such a mess.
Yeah.
And I talk about it in the show. Like I was getting nosebleeds all the time. I was a total mess.
Wow. It's like the most natural antidote to grief.
Yeah.
Is birth and life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it like life comes at you fast. It just all hit at the same time.
And you don't explore, you know, your childhood with your mother at all in the show?
No, she was great. I mean, there's so much I could tell you, but she was very private.
Yeah.
Which also makes me, that like when you ask if I'm nervous, it's like, yeah, I'm always nervous being on a podcast.
Yeah.
But she was very private, and there was stuff she never told me her whole life. Like
You don't never know your parents. It's weird. I talk about that now. It's just like you don't know.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
You have this specific kind of like narrow spectrum of experience, and they had lives. You know, they had secret lives, they had lives as adults, they had lives before you, and it's like, you just don't know. Both of my parents are still kind of hanging in there. My dad's losing his mind, and my mom's very old. And you just start to realize, like, I don't fucking, and my dad was kind of a monster. Yeah. So, like, now, like, I do a bit about that, about when they get dementia, and...
Oh, I saw that. You're like, hold on to that moment when they're...
Well, there's that, but there's, the new one is, it's like, you know, the filter goes... And the statute of limitations on what they should and shouldn't tell their kid, that goes away.
Oh,
so
God.
If you've got unresolved issues or questions, you know, just reach into that bingo cage of memories and
see
if it's
so intense.
You see if you can find the missing piece that'll make you a whole person.
So, I mean, I had the opposite experience because when she died, she was so lucid. Like I could see in her face her fear knowing that she was going to die.
Yeah.
And that haunts me till this day.
Yeah.
But to have the opposite, to see them kind of disappear while their body's still alive, feels haunting in a whole another.
Well, they're just spitting out information that becomes very poetic and interesting if you can let go of who they were, you know.
And if who they were was not the best person.
Well, yeah, yeah. And it's interesting what remains, the stubbornness and the belligerence and the anger, like a lot of that stuff, that's holding on more than what he had for breakfast. You know, like these core things. To me, after losing somebody I love tragically and quickly, you know, the framework of how I see life, it definitely shifted. And I imagine being haunted by your mom's fear and vulnerability, it's such a common human experience. Yeah. It's a very odd thing to generalize, you know, innately to make the decision to generalize it. But it's like there's nothing more common than that.
Yeah.
It's wild.
Yeah, no, and I know it is crazy how grief illiterate we are. But a lot of us are, I mean, a lot of comics are talking about it. There's like the cliche in Edinburgh, of like the dead dad show, you know?
Yeah.
And that's also maybe why part of my like reticence to cry or to talk about, I'm just like, I don't want to be part of the cliche, like I don't want to be, you know, grouped into that kind of thing. But it doesn't matter.
But also it's like it's a one show thing. And whether there's a group, like that's a much better grouping than a lot of the other types of grouping there are.
That's true.
I mean, at least you're doing something community, communally viable and helpful, and you're actually, you know, contributing to people feeling less alone in these unavoidable feelings that are going to happen to everybody. Like I can, you know, like it's okay to be a grief hack because it's not like it's.
There are so many other hacks, you know.
Yeah, the worst kinds.
Yeah. That is the hardest part when I've been doing the show. People coming up after and like kind of. Unloading their
Thank
trauma.
You. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm sure you get that.
Well, yeah, you know, but even what I get out of that is like, oh, it's everybody.
Yeah.
It's really one of the great
equalizers.
Sort of, totally.
Yeah.
Well, good luck with the show.
Thank you.
It was nice talking to you.
You too.
Okay, Jenna.
You too.
Okay.
We can do another take. Do that again.
It's great talking
wait,
to you.
Wait, now I'm directing. Okay, all do right. That again. Just do that again.
It was really great talking to you.
You too.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. I didn't know how it would all pan out, but we did it.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
I was happy to talk to her. It's been a while. Again, I should mention she'll be at the Edinburgh Fringe August 8th through 24th. With her new show, Jenna Friedman, Motherfucker. Get tickets at jennafriedman.com. Hang out for a minute, folks.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Hey people, Jenna was on a live episode of WTF from the early years, and if you have a WTF Plus subscription, you can hear all of those live episodes, like this one with Bill Hader and Fred Armisen.
You guys seem so well adjusted. When I was a kid, the mythic SNL thing was like, that place is fucked up. It's nothing but crazy over there. And not anymore?
Sweet.
It's very sweet, yeah. Everybody's Wait really a minute. Nice.
Seriously. Wait, that seemed like a talking point.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's just like...
Tell them it's sweet.
it's just very... No, it is. It's very nice. Like, people come and they want to, like, sometimes hosts come or bands and they're, like, ready to party and stuff.
And it's, it's quiet time.
Yeah, it's all quiet time. There's mats on the floor. We're taking naps.
How often do you have to deal with Lauren?
Every
day?
All the time. He's awesome. Yeah,
he's hands
great.
On.
He's very hands-on, and he's very...
Can I share with you how paranoid I am?
Yeah.
I had one meeting with him.
When?
Like, 95 or something. And it didn't go well. And, like, I think he brought me in was when Luna was starting downtown. And, like, the first thing he said to me was, like, I don't know what you think you're doing down there below 14th Street, but it doesn't matter.
It didn't matter, did it?
No, it didn't matter at all. And, but this is how fucking nuts I am and how self-important I am. It's like the Wall Street Journal wrote up this show And I told the interviewer who was asking me about, you know, Luna and that you guys were coming on, and then I told him about the SNL story, and I told him that story because he was asking me about alternative comedy, and I called him back, and I said, look, could you pull the Lorne thing out, because I don't want him to see it and then say, and then keep Fred and Bill late. Like, I thought Lorne Michaels was going to see that story and say, you guys aren't going. You're not going to the Fable WTM.
Wow.
That's crazy.
That's a good move, though.
That is. I mean, that is a good move.
You did the right thing.
You did do the right thing.
That's episode 164, live in Brooklyn. You can hear that ad-free with a WTF Plus subscription. To sign up, go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Here's kind of a messy rendition of a Velvet Underground deep cut. Monkey on the Fonda, cat angels everywhere.